welcome to the Mile 99 interview series with your hosts, Greg Larkin, Mike Turner, and Jessica Harris. Enjoy this episode, and we'll hope to see you on the trails soon. Welcome, everybody. It's the Mile 99 interview series, and this is our 18th episode. As you probably, some of you know, we talk to a different ultra runner every week, pretty much every week lately, and even this week is going to be twice a week. And we just find out something about, you know, what makes them tick, where they've been racing, even this year that people have been racing and doing some amazing things. And just kind of find out, you know, anything else that might be interesting along the way, and usually get some great stories and some good advice. I'm joined tonight, as usual, by my co-host Jessica Harris and Mike Turner. And I just want to give a little shout out to Mike. He was away when we spoke to Bob Crowley a couple weeks ago. He was down at Arizona at the Javelina 100. And he successfully completed that 100-mile race, I believe his fifth buckle. Just under 23 hours, a new PR for him. So congratulations. Woo! Mike. How are you both doing, Jessica and Mike?
Doing good. So we started this series back in May as a way to kind of keep our community connected and inspired and motivated through, like Greg said, talking to local ultra runners about what they're up to, what they're doing, just to kind of share that collective knowledge and keep people staying together and feeling like, you know, like they're connected. Jessica is over here. She's watching the chat rooms, the various rooms. We're on Facebook Live, the Aid Station, and also our site. She's tracking questions and also on the chat room on Zoom here as well. Towards the end of the show, we'll have a Q&A session, and we can go over questions from the audience and obviously Facebook Live. We want to mention a couple of friends of the show, the Aid Station, friends of ours, a great place in Auburn to get some shoes, get some beer, hang out. They have a Thursday night run, which is fun. So please visit them when you're in town. Also, our friends, Monsters of Massage, which Greg and I visit regularly. They save us from getting all those demons out. So please visit them in Newcastle as well.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Mike. Tonight, we have a really special guest. His name is Bruce Wynn. He is a recent finisher of the Moab 240 race. And some people may have heard the saying lately, 200 is the new 100-mile race. Candace Burt, she's a race organizer, lives up in Washington State. And a number of years ago, she started organizing 200-mile races. You know, 100-milers are tough. 200-milers take it to the next level. And right now, she's got the Bigfoot 200, the Tahoe 200, and the Moab 240. And unfortunately, you know, with the pandemic, Bigfoot and Tahoe were canceled this year, but Moab still ran. And so Bruce and a bunch of people, crew, pacers, and whatnot, went out there to tackle this amazingly long race out in Utah. So we have him tonight. Let's bring him in. And he's also joined by his friends, Michael and Jennifer, who crewed him and just kind of kept him moving all the way to the end of this race, which took him over 4 days. So just an absolutely amazing effort. And we want to welcome Bruce tonight. So thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello, guys. Thanks for having me. Appreciate you guys having this Mile 99 podcast. It's very informative, and I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm hoping that you're well past the recovery phase at this point and enjoying life after that effort.
Yeah, the recovery was actually better than all my 200s and my 100s. So I'm very surprised, but with all the stuff that I did and recovery and stuff I did during the race, I came out pretty strong and no injuries.
That's really excellent to hear. We're going to totally dive into the race, all of it, as much as we can fit in the hour, and obviously get to the audience Q&A like we talked about. But one thing I just wanted to start with, and we usually do this with all of our guests, is just kind of like get a little bit of backstory about you, you know, how you kind of got started in running, I looked back at, you know, your pre-interview questionnaire, and it sounds like, you know, you did a 5K and like that was your entry into running. And I'm just curious about, you know, how you found running and, you know, what made you decide to even do that first race?
Yeah. My first race was the 5K, Susan Komen's cancer fundraising. And my friends got a group together and I ran that one. It was in Cal Expo and I had a blast. I didn't know I could run that fast and that distance. I never ran that before. And then, I looked online and I grew up in Marin and I saw this 50K. I'm like, how can that be? So I signed up for 50K in Marin, which is the Marin Ultra Challenge. And that was a painful, you know, of just learning. I just came in there with a backpack and, you know, camel pack and some other gear that's not normal running gear, just tennis shoes. And I got hooked. So Marin, those trails in Marin just hooked me and I never looked back.
Wow. And I mean, those are not easy trails. I mean, you know, you got climbs, you got crazy descents. I mean, all kinds of stuff out there, right?
Yeah. Yeah. My friend thought I was crazy, but I got him to come along with me and we both just suffered together and we finished. I think we were like the last 10 people or something like that. But
yeah. Do you remember how long it took you to finish that one?
Probably like 8.5 or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, as a first effort though, like for a 50K, that's pretty good, I think, if you're out there in Marin.
Yeah.
You got some serious elevation and all that. And so, you know, like, were you active as a kid? Like, was this sort of like a brand new thing for you in terms of getting into like any kind of endurance sports?
I've been always inactive. I wrestled all through high school, did wrestling and track all through high school, all 4 years. But never running. It was just one of those things where either I was just no passion, just didn't have time to run. I was just a very athletic person, but no running. Mm-hmm. And so, but I like challenges. So I'm just that way. I like to learn and particularly active stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you've certainly found some challenges as we're going to dive into here. and so I looked through your ultra sign up. I do that with a lot of the guests just to get a sense of what their trajectory has been. And it does look like, I mean, you went from that 50K distance, you ramped up to 50 milers, 100Ks, and then 100 milers, like within a couple of years, I would say so.
8 years total. Yeah. 8 years now.
So that's a pretty, you know, like that's a pretty good, upgrade, I would say, like in a fairly short amount of time. Did you feel just like this is like a natural activity for you, or, you know, what prompted you to kind of keep going up in those distances? Was it just, like you said, the challenge?
Mainly it, the challenge, but the community. I just like being out there on the trails. I, you know, this all actually started because of my past, because I used to have anxiety and my doctor diagnosed me with anxiety problems and tension headaches and stuff, and they would give me these pills and I didn't like to take those pills because it would just put me to like brain dead. And so and that's why I started running, and that solved the whole thing. And my doctor's like, hey, keep doing what you're doing, and so I got off of that for like like a year after that. So I haven't been taking that medicine for a while. So, and I'm not going to plan on taking it because I keep doing what I like to do.
And yeah.
Brain busy. But yeah, the challenge is I like to learn and keep, you know, challenging myself while I'm learning and trying to dial everything that, you know, dial everything that went wrong. And then, you know, and just keep challenging myself. And I'm there because I like to run races and meet all these new people. And I like just the thought of someone, you know, of me having problems and someone helping me. And then I have to pay back the return, you know, pay back, and I help other people. So I like that kind of community where everybody's always watching out for each other. and trying to get to the next level and teaching each other.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and I know Mike can comment on this, like many of us have come into this sport pretty much not knowing anything, and you go out and that's kind of why we're doing this. You know, we've been doing this series since May, is that, you know, we still want to be able to exchange this information. I know people are going to get a lot out of what you talked to us about tonight. And I know, you know, I personally learned a lot from just running with people in this area. Mike has learned a lot from running with people. I'm sure everybody else, Jessica, and, you know, we all have our little crew of people and we feed off of them and we all share. And it sounds like you've been able to do the same thing.
Yeah.
That's so great. And like who do you train with, I guess, normally, like when you're, you know, preparing for a race, do you have like a set number of people that you go with and that sort of thing? Or
honestly, the first 7 years, I've been just training on myself, because my schedule is so irregular, and I just go out there and, you know, the common Auburn trails and no hands and stuff like that. But I get it, just go there, get it done. But recently, the last couple of years, I've been joining, you know, running clubs and Tuesdays, Wednesdays, just to get some maintenance on that Cavett in the Folsom Lake area.
Oh, yeah.
The day. Yeah. And then recently, Mike, I met Mike Lee, and he's very organized and on the point. And he's been inviting me to his back to back. And so I've never done most of these back to backs with other people. And his back to backs are like Tahoe and a lot of vert. And so he got into me to this groove. And then, it's so much easier when you have a group of people. It's accountability. And you go out there and, you know, you have fun too. So I was grinding the first 7 years, you know, mostly a lot by myself and just running races and learning from people. It's just because of my schedule.
Yeah. Well, I saw either in your race report or in your race report and also in your pre-interview questionnaire. I mean, you have a family, you know, you've got a lot going on. And just talking about like training, I mean, you're taking it to the next level. You're doing the 200 mile distances now. Like, how much more training do you have to do those races? And how do you fit that in with a family and a job and every other responsibility you might have?
I try to balance it. Balance my training, but it's spontaneous. Sometimes I just don't have 2 days, and I'm with my boys and the whole family. Then sometimes I just have both days, running days. So I'll take that any opportunity. But recently I was surprised to see that my Strava mileage went down. The more I ran my races. So I guess I'll substitute my races, but, it's more quality now, training than just every day going out there doing my 10. It's more like Saturday and Sundays back to back. And then weekends, I might miss the whole weekend. So it's spontaneous. And it's, I think, when you're looking for a race, you need that vert, then you just do a whole bunch of verts. If you're doing the high mileage and multi races, then you work on the sleep deprivation and the planning. And I just use races to help me be successful.
Yeah. Oh, it's gotta be tough though. Yeah. Like just being opportunistic about your training and, you know, just grabbing those minutes or those hours or half a day here and there kind of thing. I mean, I can appreciate like how much, time management, how much, you know, you have to have time management skills to do all that. That's definitely got to be a challenge.
I'm very spontaneous.
Yeah.
I don't plan a lot. I just do it. Here's an example. Me and Mike have been planning to do the Tahoe 200 since it got canceled, but we had a plan to go around the whole lake and do the TRT 171. Plus the, you know, 30 some miles or 29 miles. And then all that blew up with the whole Tahoe Basin closure during the smoke.
Right.
And so we scrambled trying to figure out which trails were open, and they end up closing everything. And we basically gave up because we tried to do some repeat somewhere in Tahoe, but it was, everything was closed. And then we found out the Spooner area was open, but we didn't know for sure what was open, where we can go. So we kind of just say, hey, we'll just leave it. And we gave up, and it was just no point. And then that Friday, I went to go train, and I just got really bummed and wanted to go training in Auburn. And then I'm heading to Auburn, and I see all the smoke, and there's just no way. So I said, I'm going to turn around and I'm going to go to Utah. This was my mind. I was just, because I saw the Wasatch Mountains were open.
Yeah.
And Facebook people said, where's the water stations there? Where you can get water creeks and stuff. And I just turned around and I said to my wife, I said, I have a week of vacation. What am I going to do? So I'm going to go train or run my 200, whatever I can do in Wasatch. And so I turned around, packed all my stuff, and just started heading west. And I said, well, I'm going to pull over to, since I'm going that way, I'm going to pull over to Spooner and talk to the ranger. So I talked to the ranger there. I pulled into the TRT finish starting line where they start. And I pulled in and I told the rangers, hey, what's going on here? And they said, yeah, this whole vast Spooner backcountry is open. And I said, really? And I said, they said all the way to Tunnel Creek. And I said, so they gave me the okay. I got the okay. And there was no smog at that area. There was no smoke or anything. And I said, what about camping? And I said, I read camping. And they said, well, you could camp in the backcountry, but you can't camp in your car. So you can leave your car here overnight? And they said, yes, as long as you're not camping in your car or at the Spooner Lake area. And so I said, well, what if I'm just out there for 4 days, 200 miles running in circles? And they said, it's fine. As long as you don't set up tent or anything in the parking lot or designated area, you're okay. So it's 12 o'clock noon. And I said, I called Michael and I said, this is what I'm up to. If you want to join me, Michael's in San Jose or in the Bay Area. And he said, wow, that's kind of far. And he looked at the stuff and he said, no, maybe. So I said, well, I'm going to start. You can always join me. So at this time, it was that 150 air quality index. So it was kind of iffy for him to come all the way here and in a spotty. So I just started and I called Roger, which is our plan B was to run behind his backyard in Truckee, but then it was closed also. And then he came down next morning to join me for 50 miles for fun. And he ended up doing 205 miles with me.
Whoa.
So we both did the Tahoe virtual testing 200 there.
Right.
And I had a couple people come and help me with logistics, but I just camped in my car and he camped in his Sprinter van. And we did this all night long. And then we found this other crew from South Africa, something that was also training and doing the test Tahoe and training for the Moab. And they had their husband and doing it off of Tunnel Creek. So they were crewing and doing loops up in Tunnel Creek. And then we bumped into them. So it was everything came together and it worked. And we had a blast. And that was the first time I really tested myself solo.
Wow.
Being out there, it was an adventure for sure.
I mean, that had to be a huge confidence builder for the 240 then, because you basically took a situation which wasn't looking good. You completely changed your mindset. You know, you went out there with just some focus and, hey, if other people want to join, great, but I got to do this thing. And
Yeah. That's
like the test of ultimate flexibility right there. And I'm sure that kind of attitude serves you well when you're in the 240 and you're running into all kinds of issues, which we can get into now. Like I read your race report and I mean, just the things you had to go through for that race. Do you want to just basically kick it off by describing the race and sort of like, you know, your arrival there and such.
Yeah, logistics is the big one for 240 miles. I've done the, you know, tall 200 and attempted the Bigfoot 200. Logistically, it's a lot. It's a lot of work. But you could do your best and then just toe the line. And I knew that is from experience from other people saying tall, you know, Moab's pretty remote, and so I tried my best to settle my minivan and make my crew comfortable. And I got a crew together, so I was gonna end up doing solo, but I ended up two people, which was very special. And that was the only way I could get my elevated legs to work, to get that electronics to work, remote, you know, off grid. Yeah, so the Moab 240 is just a long desert with a couple mountain ranges. It's a race that has the weather changes. The range is so big, you know, you could go from really cold to really hot, and that's you don't find that in Bigfoot or 200, Bigfoot or Tahoe. So Moab is that extreme. So be prepared to have gear for those two extreme situations.
Bruce, is it a point to point, or is it a loop?
It's a big loop. Yeah. It's a big loop. Let's see, big loop. Yeah, Tahoe is a big loop, and then Bigfoot is a point to point. It's a big loop. You're going to see a lot of that same red rock, massive mesas and plateaus, and neat stuff out there. Totally different. I've never ran in the desert before, but you see a lot of carcasses and bones, and it was pretty neat. It was a different experience. I like the heat.
You're talking about animals, right?
Yeah. So, logistically, I think it was you have to be prepared. And then running this was total. I knew that there's no vert really. It was just long, steady climbs, and vertical verts like steep is not that much. Not like compared to Bigfoot and Tahoe. So I knew it's going to be a long, long, just shuffling, long shuffling. And it's a mind game. And from all my experience, and Roger Pineapple from Truckee, he did a triple crown, and he's done Moab twice already. And he said, it's just a mind game. And it's going to, nothing physical. It's just mostly mind and the straightaways. And so I was ready for that. I was ready for the mindset to go out and whatever. And yeah, it's a mindset when you go out there for a Moab, for sure. If you're not up to the adventure, up to all the changing twists and turns, you have to be prepared. Yeah.
Hey, Bruce, what are the high and low elevations on the course? What type of elevations are you getting into?
I don't remember, but the changes is not high. It's I think it's like 4 to 9, but the change, you're not at 9 all the time, like or 7 to 9, like at Tahoe, but you're more at the lower 5 to 6,000. And then you have to keep climbing and you go back down, but you're not ever that high for a long time. So it's not, the elevation is not a factor at all at this race. It's just the heat and the change of weather that we had. Actually, everybody was way off guard. And that's the thing is you've got to bring your gear no matter what for any changes. And I've seen people, oh, the first 3 days was super hot. And during the night, even 2 o'clock in the morning, I had my t-shirt on. That was true. But on the third night, it was freezing cold. And I did my write up. And it caught a lot of people off guard, and they underestimated the weather changes. You're not focused on the weather that much, unless your crew is always on it. But there's those expected events that might happen along the way, and it bites you in the butt if you don't get your gear right. And you're not doing a checklist, and even one simple gear I mean, if the bivy emergency bivy, if you don't have that, that is a game changer. If you don't have that, it's life threatening too, right? So I've done so many situations where people are caught in snow and without any gear, and then they have to turn around, and it's just sad to, I mean, you lessons learned, but you invest so much on a race like that, and to just put that and not bring that gear that only weighs like an ounce, you know, you don't take it for granted. The weather's Mother Nature. You can only survive Mother Nature, but you can't beat Mother Nature. Yeah, you can lose to Mother Nature or survive, but you can't beat Mother Nature, and they will get you. So plan on bringing all your gear, train with all your gear, and don't take the gear out of your bag. And you know, we made a little brain fart, and I forgot my puffy jacket. Most people don't bring puffy jackets, and that's a super 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 cold. That's just an extra fear, but it's not required. I had it all 4 days, but it's that one strip, that 1-2 seconds, I didn't have it, and it kind of almost ended my race. So
I remember reading that in your race report. So you had to borrow the puffy jacket from your pacer at that moment, yeah. I guess.
Yeah, I borrowed. He lent it to me because I was getting cold, and he wasn't even using it, but he didn't bring any other gear. So now that was a problem. Now he couldn't stay cold, stay warm enough to be, you know, to do anything. So I had all my gear. So it was just long story short, the best decision was for him to just go on to the next ages by himself and run off because he couldn't stay warm enough because I was going too slow.
Yeah.
And I was wearing all my gear and I was comfortable. So, but I didn't want him to get any hypothermia or anything like that because that would just ruin the whole thing. And we both agreed and that's what happened. So unfortunately, you know, things happen and, you know, he's a pacer and he knows he needs to bring all this stuff. And I have no idea why he didn't choose to bring any of his gear. He's done his Tahoe 200 before 3 times. He's been in worse situations and snow and all this stuff. And he chose not to bring it. So it was kind of unfortunate and that's what happened. So, but lessons learned. I mean,
if anybody hasn't read your race report, it's on Facebook and it's a good read and it shows how organized and prepared you are. And I respect it because I believe in being prepared and organized. And so going through it, I really enjoyed how you had your gear, you had extra gear, you carried extra stuff in case someone else didn't have theirs.
Yeah.
You had your electronics, you had your maps, you knew where the trail was. I mean, you were not going to let anything go to waste. I mean, if something happened to you and you weren't prepared for it, it was going to be something you wouldn't have thought about because you really were thorough from what I read in your report.
Yeah, from all my races and I ran Tahoe 200 in 2017. And then I paced 2 years in a row at Tahoe 200 to get my runners to the finish line. And then I attempted a Bigfoot 200. It's all about gear. It's you got to make sure you got your gear and you're prepared for the worst case scenario. And you invest so much time and money. Why not, you know, bring that stuff? You can't, it's just risk management, basically. And then you have to execute. I've you know, just being around people, learning stuff. And recently, you know, it's risk management is very important in organizing. So I wish I was more organized, but I knew how these 200s are. You have, the 200 is a long race and anything can happen, but you have a lot of time to fix it. So it's always, it's a long time to have a lot of things go wrong, but you do have a lot of time to fix it. And the way I do things is just be patient the whole race, just be patient. I've seen runners, I mean, 50Ks, 50 miles, 100 miles, they go out, boom, they go out and they, you know, bite them in the end, but they go out too fast. But even a 200, they still go out too fast. Hmm. And in the long run, that muscle fatigue is never going to come back. And it's going to be a painful to get that back. And then you're going to waste a lot of time on other stuff like medical or sleeping and just to get that the glucose back. And I've learned that, you know, that it's just patience because it's about finishing the race and surviving the race. It's not about time or anything like that. And, you know, people, they want goals, but they have to be realistic about their goals and about their pacing because 200 miles, it's really hard to predict what's going to happen. You could have charts and pacings and stuff like that. The way I approach these kind of 200 mile races is I don't have pace charts or anything. I just say, if I'm moving and I'm walking, that's 3 miles an hour. And if I'm shuffling, I'm banking more sleep. So, and then I'm prepared for anything that happens. That's, I'm just free-minded like that. I'm just ready to solve problems. And I like doing that. I like solving problems. And you have to be patient because if you don't be patient, it's just going to kill you in the mindset. You're going to start going fast and just sleeping longer. So patience to solve problems. That's how I tell people and that's how I run my races. It's a lot of patience.
Excellent advice. Yeah, I like the idea of you having more time to fix things. That's attractive about a 200. We have two people that joined you at the race here, Michael and Jennifer, and we'd just like to unmute them and have them introduce themselves and just say what their roles were in your amazing journey here.
Jen, go ahead.
Hi, Jen.
Okay, I'm Jen. Hi. I take Bruce and crewed him. And that was my first time ever pacing or crewing, so it was a lot of fun. I paced him for two sections, about 30 miles each.
I think four sections, right?
What?
Is it four sections?
I paced only two, and then there were
crewed. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. It was four, because I always forget the...
Yeah, you paid me two in a row.
So two 30-mile block, yeah.
Yeah, two 30-mile blocks. Yeah.
Nice. What can you say about Bruce's condition when you're out there?
No, it was amazing. Like, he was just smiling all the time, just always moving. even when we were in the LaSalle's, and that was hard, because that was probably where all the, well, from what I saw on the map, and, you know, there was a lot of elevation gain in that. And still smiling, still having a great time, still moving so fast going uphill, like these steep climbs that were in the LaSalle's. He was just super fast, just going straight up the hills at mile 200. It was amazing.
Nice. And now you also crewed him at the same time not at the same time, but like when you weren't pacing, you were also crewing.
Yeah.
And how, like, what kind of challenge was that?
The biggest challenge was getting from place to place because everything was kind of far apart. So I would, I'd be pacing him and then we'd get in around like midnight and then I'd have to get to the next, spot that I would meet them at. And then I'd still, you know, they'd be these super windy, narrow roads and, you know, maybe it wasn't safe to drive at night. So I'd have to, you know, have enough time to sleep and then get everything ready and then be ready to meet them at the next aid station and get there on time. Make sure I get there on time. So that was probably the biggest thing. And then also having no service at some aid stations, that was pretty stressful.
Yeah. I was just going to ask, I mean, I can't imagine the cell coverage out there is great.
Well, I had an inReach and then Bruce had an inReach. So we would talk to each other sometimes on the inReach. But, you know, there were, I think maybe one or two nights you didn't have the inReach or we couldn't get in communication with each other, but having that, that was really helpful. A lot of aid stations, there was no service.
Yeah. Wow. And so Michael, what were you doing while Bruce was out there? What was your role?
I actually was crewing a different runner, but we are the two, my runner and Bruce, are actually pretty much the same pace. So as such, we end up getting into the same aid station pretty much almost the same time. Either the one runner will come through and then the second runner is not far behind. So I end up always sticking behind and helping out wherever I can. I was going to add one thing about the difference that why the gear is so important in this particular, in 200 milers, is that the distance between the aid stations are generally a lot further compared to a traditional 100 mile race, where you may have like a 10 mile, 13 mile would be the longest. Here, you can easily, between an aid station, can be a 20 miles to 25 miles would be a bare minimum. So when you are in a situation like when we were at Tahoe last year, Tahoe 200, I was pacing my runner, and between a 10-mile block, 10-mile section, we ran into snow because we're climbing up into high grounds. And it starts from rain as you go higher, and because you got soaked, when you get higher, it gets colder, everything becomes freezing, and you never warmed up again. So things can change in a hurry very, very quickly, and that's where the emergency gear, having being prepared like Bruce was talking about, and having extra, just think of not only just for yourself, I always carry two bivvies, one for me and one for just in case. If I were to help someone else and I have to leave one with them, I don't want to give my way, right? So carrying extra, not only, but that means you got to train with that, get used to the load and get used to the weight that you're carrying, a certain amount of volume on a regular basis, just survival, right?
Yeah, when you get past the 100 miles, you're going to go like between 2 to 3 miles an hour. So at a 20-mile section, that's 10 hours. Mm-hmm. So you might think that you start during the day, but you end up at night, and to get into the aid station in the middle of wee nights. And yeah, so the temperature change could drop dramatically because you thought you started at noon and then you end up at midnight to finish the next section. So that's why it's critical to bring all the gear. She, you know, Candace requires to bring all these gears, but it's supposed to be checked, but you know, it's you're responsible for your own safety and your crew's safety and everybody's safety too.
Yeah.
But to check everybody Bruce... but that's just a rule of thumb. Just bring all your gear, train with it, and then there's no excuse not to take it out. And here's a trick I do is I work at a desk, so I wear my back all day long for a whole month.
Whoa.
Just to get used to it. And I go into meetings and do my job. I was like, why are you wearing that? I need to wear it to get my... And so each time I go to aid station, it feels so heavy just holding it, but then when I put it on my shoulders, it's just better. Mm-hmm. I don't even feel the weight anymore because I'm so used to that weight, and that's how I get by. It's just work on it on.
Wow.
On my desk and stuff like that.
An extra point that I want to add, as I crew my runner as well as pacing him the last 40 miles. And something to consider as a pacer for a longer distance race of such is that you have to be prepared that as a pacer, because just because I have fresh legs, they are at 200. I jumped in the last 40 miles. My runner had already ran 200 miles. So there's a maximum speed that they can go at that I can't push them further. So sometimes I might do the math and say, all right, well, 40 miles is going to be, well, 20 hours. Doesn't work like that, because by then they're sleep deprived, they're fatigued, they have different issues, blisters, and so you might be actually out there a lot longer than what you anticipate. So you need to make sure that you stay warm and you can take care of yourself so that you're not a liability to your runner, right?
Hey, Bruce, I want to get into your race report a little bit in the middle, because I really enjoyed reading it, especially I want to hear about the story about placing shapes of rocks on the trail in front of you, and then you're calling your friend and Truckee. Maybe go through that, because that's just a story. So I was laughing so hard.
I had a great time in that section. I knew the dangers of it, but because I'm experienced with my Tahoe 200, so with the 200 miles, I was so Charles, my pacer, he didn't have the gear, and he was so cold that I just tell him to go forward. So I was left by myself the last like 6 miles to get to the station. But it was the longest straightaway. Everything looked the same in the middle of the night. The stars were beautiful, and I was just walking along and just kept moving forward. And then I'd get these weird doubts in my mind. So here's the mind game, right? So I was prepared. You know, something's going on. I realized that that my mind is playing tricks on me. So everything looked the same, and I'm moving forward, but really, am I really moving forward? I've read a lot of race reports and people going in loops and just dreaming or hallucinating. And so I just had to play this game back on myself and have fun with it. So to test that out, I would take these gravel rocks, and on this dirt trail, I'd make them into of shapes, arrows, diamonds, or whatever that I could recognize. If I had passed it again on that same path, that means I am going in circles and I'm doing something wrong. So I put in these shapes on the ground, and I was like, good idea. So I'm just going along. And then I'm staring at the floor trying to look for it. And I started imagining that they are there. So that was funny, because as much as I wanted to see, didn't want to see it, I was imagining that I placed them down. And so I was seeing them everywhere. And so I was doubting myself again. And I started, hey, let's just have fun. Let's just call someone and see, and see. So I immediately call the person that that would understand what I'm going through, that could be reachable. So I call Roger Pineapple's wife, Lori. They're great couple. I see them all the time in the 200 mile races, and they've helped me before, and they brought him in before during races, and they helped me. So Lori picks up the phone, and I tell Lori, hey, I'm by myself out here and it's cold and I'm not sure. And I forgot my jacket and stuff like that. And hey, can you have someone get me a jacket? But she also told me, like, you'd be disqualified, right? And said, yeah. So I asked her if she could check. So she went online, she checked, and I was moving forward, and she said, yes, you are moving forward. And it's like four more miles ahead, and just keep moving forward. You're doing great. And that she reassured me, like she always does. I called her before in Tahoe 200, Tessie, that I did with Roger solo, and she's always picked up the phone and tracking us. So I get off the phone, and I was confident that I'm going forward, and I just need to keep moving my legs forward. But a minute later, I'm just like, was I on the phone with her? So it came back, this doubt and this kind of hallucinating state came back, and I'm staring at my phone. I say, well, I dialed it, but am I hallucinating all this stuff? So I had to make that call again. So I called her back to make sure that I wasn't hallucinating, that I was calling her. And she said, yes, you were talking to me and you did dial, and yeah. So I had a great time on that section, even though it was cold, but I was fully aware of where I was. I did have enough sleep and stuff like that. I wasn't to the point where I was seeing animals and stuff like that. So that's when you really, this was just isolated, you know, tests for me that I had fun doing it.
That's great. I was cracking up reading that part. Also your race report near the end, I think it's really valuable. You go through a list of things that went right and things you do differently. you know, if you want to quickly go through some of those things that went right, and maybe some of the things, a lot of us here have done ultras and hundreds, and we're 200s are in a lot of our future. So it's nice to hear what you would do differently and what was right.
Organization. I'd make sure you're organized and stuff like that for your crew and yourself. You can never go, the more organized, the better your race will come out. That's just risk management. I wish I was more organized. I loaded my van with just overload of just stuff. And now I realize I did pack a lot, but I was always having plan A, plan B and stuff like that. So more organized. Also, pacing and crewing. So this is a lesson that I've learned, that it was okay to have these kind of stuff during a shorter distances, but I've realized that pacing and crewing at the same time is a tough job for a long 4-day thing. Regular race is 100 mile. Yeah, they could be sleep deprived for one day, right? For one night, that's fine. They could still be functional. But if they're going off 2 or 3 or 4 days, they might not get the sleep that they need because they're so busy doing stuff. So I didn't put that together when I had this team. And so I've learned that is very important to maybe reduce the sections, one section at a time, or have just sole responsibility of just crewing and pacing. No matter what, how much their capability is, they might be so busy that they can't get the naps in, and you don't know that because you're running your race and you're not logistically evaluating them if they're capable. So that's a risk management that I you need to figure out. And I've learned that a 200 mile race, yeah, reduce your pacing with pacer responsibilities, maybe reducing the crewing responsibility and have more crew. I was on thin crew, right? It's a minimum of 2 person to leapfrog, to trade the car and trade off. So Jennifer did a great job. She's never done anything over 40 miles, I thought, of running and stuff. And she ran a lot with me and she crewed while pacing too. And, you know, so I give it up to her, for making this trip happen, because it could have been really more stressful for me.
Let's hear from her for a second too about that. I just want to get a little more into it, like what she was going through, like switching between crewing and pacing. Like, how was that transition for you? And like, were you able to get enough sleep and, you know, other things that were going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, I did, that was something I made sure of. I'm not very good at staying up overnight. I haven't done that in so long. And there was one section where I thought I was going to be pacing overnight. So I definitely made sure I was sleeping so that I could be awake while Bruce is sleepwalking or sleep running, you know. but yeah, it was a little stressful, you know, just making sure that we slept enough and made sure we had everything ready, made sure we got to the aid stations on time. But it was still such a great experience, even with all of that.
And that may inspire you to do some longer distances at some point.
No, we talked about it the whole time. We did start planning like everything.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you've got so much time when you're out there pacing somebody. Yeah, you can just kind of let your minds go and figure out what the future holds. That's cool. It sounds like it was a great experience for you. And that's really positive. And I'm sure it helps. Obviously, it helps to have somebody out there with you, Bruce, as you're, you know, going into some of these sections. I know that, I mean, I've heard of, and I think you alluded to in your trip report too, or your race report, that, you know, there are people out there that do these things essentially solo. Is that true?
Because of COVID, that a lot of people did solo for Moab 240. Their crew and stuff didn't want to get into that situation with a lot of people. It's personal stuff, but a lot of people did solo. So it was a record 60 drops for the first like section or something, first two sections for the first day. It's just because of the heat and all this stuff. And I wasn't sure, you know, everybody's, yeah, it's just a no, a lot of people, yeah, I don't know what was the circumstances. Everybody had their own issues, but it was a record drop. So
there's an interesting, good question, Greg, because I know that Ray Sanchez is on here. We interviewed him a month or so ago, and you know, he's done a lot of long distance races, and he believes in going alone. And I'm just trying to think about, I guess it's a personal preference of, you know, because if you have crew, you could be stressed out. It could give you anxiety. Would they be there? Would they not be there? Worrying about them. Does that build it? Is there anxiety there?
It's true. It's true. I would recommend like these 200s to have a crew and pacer for the first time around. So I've been so experienced, and now I know how to take my naps and stuff. So my next goal would one day, I would like to do a 200 solo, just to get that different challenge with the different dimension of this feeling to be by yourself and self-supporting such a long. And I, you know, I did actually did Tahoe 200 Tessie like that. So I like that, being out there, being really afraid for my, you know, being afraid but in control, right? And taking care of myself. It's just a whole new dimension when you're out there by yourself and knowing that there's no one out there that's going to help you wake up. That's a big advantage, is these trail naps. A lot of people have these anxieties that, oh, I'm never going to wake up. You know, I need to just nap for 10 minutes and I wake up an hour later from missing cutoffs. And that's what happens. Also, it happens on crews too. Crew would forget to wake you up too. I've heard that stuff. Yeah, but it's so important for the first 200 miles if you're doing it, get that pacer and crew and get that sleep nap in. And I think everybody's learning that trick now, is not the big long sleeps, but it's the trail naps that will help prevent the hallucinations and will help prevent you from doing that zombie or that slow half mile pace. Is because you start thinking, I'm moving, but you're not moving fast. And that's what I was having at the earlier years when these 200s were, they were just pushing their body because they were thinking, I'm moving. I've learned that taking a 10 minute nap and moving 4 miles, 3 miles an hour, walking pretty fast, then stumbling for an hour, going half mile an hour. So you don't get really nowhere and you're suffering. So here's a side note, it was my Rio de Lago. Last year, I did my PR with an hour of sleep, a total nap time during a 100 miler. So because my other 100 milers, I would just be stumbling in the middle of the night, going one, you know, half mile an hour. But now I can take naps and I'm just zooming past everybody because they're stumbling on 100 mile. So was evidence that sleep cat naps work.
So one of our questions from Facebook from Lisa is, she was asking, what is your sleep strategy during the race? And so you're talking, do you have an actual, like, every hour I take 10 minutes, or is it kind of by feel? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Every race is different because you don't know when you're going to come in and how long it took and why your tiredness is, your fatigue is when you get into that. It seemed like Moab was like every aid station after the sleep station was a 1 hour sleep time. And then in between the sections, I had like one to two, three naps to just keep my insanity and my hallucinations, on track. That's for Moab, but a Tahoe 200, might be different. I might take a whole bunch of cat naps and then take like 90 minute major, after major climbs or major aid stations. It's adapting. But I think that strategy is good for me now. It's just this out 1 hour. I might even do that for the Bigfoot and Tahoe, is 1 hour naps and and the cat naps, but it's basically time management too. Right? You don't want to spend too long. Depends on how much cutoff time is, what kind of, you know, Moab 240, I think is the easiest out of all these three, but that's my preference. It's just a longer time to fix problems. It's a longer time to get in trouble, but overall, the cutoffs is really generous.
Awesome. And so Lisa was also wondering, kind of switching gears a little bit about your training, what's your highest weekly mileage when you're training for a 200? Not necessarily Moab, but kind of.
Yeah, kind of. I think I average Strava, I average like 20 miles a week.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not, I was very stunned that I was averaging actually less than that. I think it was less, but I have to look at it again. And I was, and I posted on Facebook, I said, I don't understand, you know, but it is, I think it's quality and going into being prepared. I'm a slow runner. I'm in the back of the pack, kind of like I've graduated to like the front or the back of the pack for my 8 years, but I've always struggled ever since I started. And I'm not a fast runner, but I make it up through logistics, my time spent at aid stations, my blister management. So I just carved down my time is just because all this risk management and all this stuff is to help me look faster. But I think I've been always this speed. One note is I've done a lot of hill training now, so I'm very comfortable at muscle memory from my hills. So I used to hate hills like everybody else starting, but I've trained my muscle memory to just climb hills now. And you know, the coaches will tell you walk with authority, and that's what you do, and you just get that muscle memory. If you could do it, I don't train on flats or hills anymore. I just go hills. I just do hills is my focus because that's the pain cave, right? So if you get out of that, if you can comfortably go up hills, that reduces your pain cave, your stress level. And that's where I'm at. But also I've recently learned that downhill is actually important too, because it affected my downhill in Bigfoot 200 because my quads wasn't ready. But my training is mostly just hills, repeats, a lot of vert. Because hills take time and I don't have time. So I use my time just running hills, repeats.
You gotta fit it in anywhere you can.
Yeah, usually I did that 4 mile loop that I always do on the training hill.
Oh yeah.
But then I said I'm wasting my time going around the hill, the mountain. So I just go straight up and down.
Up and down, up and down.
Yeah, because
it's efficient.
Yeah, you're spending an hour, you know, you can go up and down twice instead of going around. And so I think the roller coaster is a fun downhill, but I don't think there's a benefit for me. And because my time didn't have time. So I'd rather just do two repeats. Yeah. So it's a lot of quality training. If you don't have the time, so the quality of the training and what you're
and then on. I have another question from Karen. She was asking how much night training you do and how do you train for the night.
I don't do any night training as far as like adamantly. Hey, I'm scheduled to do a night training. I don't do those night trainings. I like running in the night, but if you just take naps, then you're okay. So you won't be sleep deprived, right? So if you take those naps, if you're disciplined and you know, and you're not, and you know that you're struggling, then just pull over, take a nap. And so night doesn't matter during the day or night. If you could take naps anywhere, anytime, doesn't matter what day or time, because you know that you're in that state, you take a nap and you wake up and you're like good for another 10, 20 miles. Night training is not as important, but naps is recognizing that you're slower than you are.
Excellent advice, I think, for anybody considering one of these, you know, because it's just, you just have to take a completely different approach than any of your other types of ultras up to, you know, 100 miles and whatnot.
Patience.
Patience. So yeah, we're coming up to the top of the next hour, and but I did just want to briefly just hear from Michael and Jennifer also about just what it was like to see Bruce coming in that final 2-3 or final mile or whatever it was where you saw him. Like, what was going through your minds as you saw him after such a epic duration of a race?
Well, I had actually just ran my runner in about 3 hours prior. So we made a determination, where are we going to stick around? Because he just finished 240 miles, my runner. And then we were just like, we know Bruce is 4 miles away. So it's about an hour and a half. So we make a determination, do we stay or do we have to bring him back to the hotel? He and I actually talked about it. And before he start the Moab from doing Tahoe 200, he had a little bit of an issue with his foot. Bruce, you talked about that in your race report, and from tendonitis, something to that effect. Yeah. And so I was really worried from the very get-go that you know, God, you now have to go attack another 240 miles. But I told him, I made him a promise that I will actually see him at the finish to bring him in. And so and also throughout the 4 days that I ran into Jennifer and other people like Roger and figure out that what he had emotionally went through with some of the challenge that above beyond the course, but just the logistics and things that he had ran into, it was even more important that to actually see him there. And so we decided to actually surprise him by hiding behind a rock. I think that was and pop out and surprise him. But it was all emotion. I mean, anybody who actually watched that video, I think it's pretty hard to have a dry eye. Yeah, I cried, you know, and I didn't even run the race, but I saw him, and I think when he saw us, that was the moment that he realized that okay, he can let go now. So that everything kind of just came out. And I know he had just talked to his wife and kids as well prior to that, so the emotion was very raw, very, very raw. But kudos to him.
There's a quick tip that I wanted to that about napping that I've learned, and I haven't seen other people do it, but that Splace blanket, Mylar, very light. I always lay it down on the ground and nap on it. It's because if you have that equipment, you're likely to take the naps, because the hardest part is finding where to take the naps, on needles, on gravel, on other stuff. So if you have that Mylar, you put it on and you sleep anywhere. Well, you're tired anywhere. It doesn't matter. You can sleep on gravel or nails or whatever. But that Mylar helps prevent that ground sucking all that heat from your body. So it makes you very comfortable, and it bounces that heat back, so then you fall asleep really quick. Mm. I know of my past, I've had struggles trying to take naps because I was freezing cold, or I wasn't cold until I laid on the ground, and that ground will just suck all your warmth out. And then you're like, I can't sleep now, or I'm struggling and I'm shivering. So that Mylar blanket, very lightweight, it's worth carrying around, and it's easy to fold back up, squish it back up. And that's I like doing that. Actually, I have fun laying that out and sleeping on it, and then, you know, so it's a good tip.
Yeah, great advice. I've been carrying one of those, and I certainly will be through the winter, I'm sure, on some of the more remote hikes, or, you know, runs and hikes. Jennifer, what was your experience there when you guys surprised Bruce at the end?
Well, like Michael said, it was a super emotional and also amazing experience, because, you know, we followed Bruce the whole way, you know, just like knowing how tired he was and also how hard he worked, you know, it was just like, it was such an amazing experience to be there at the end. And, you know, it was also so emotional for all of us, because, you know, we knew how hard he worked to get there. And yeah.
Yeah. Another thing is I was never in this kind of state on all my 200 miles. I'm in mental state, and I made it an effort to be patient in all my races, and particularly this race, and also be waiting for any adventure, so that you're always, your mind's always waiting for this, okay, what's going to happen, and so you're not surprised. So you want to be in that state where hey, I'm waiting for anything that's going to happen and be open-minded.
Perfect. And yeah, just having that mindset, I mean, obviously allowed you to push through every challenge you hit during the race, and you came out successful on the other end. So I just want to congratulate you, and I'm sure everyone else will too.
Thank you so much.
Job well done. Well, thanks so much, Bruce. Really appreciate all of your insights, you know, just kind of describing what that experience was like. Also, Michael and Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Really helpful. I always find it, and I think we all do, like, really nice to hear the other side of the story, you know, because everybody has their different perceptions of how the race goes. And it's great to hear the runner, but it's also great to hear the people that support the runner, because it's a team. And obviously it's a team sport, even though it's a runner in the race by themselves. So yeah. Thank you all so much. Just want to take a couple seconds here. First of all, it's Veterans Day. We all here at the Mile 99 Interview want to wish all of our veterans, past and present, you know, so much thanks for keeping us safe, putting their lives on the line for us every day. We don't know what we would do without you all. So thank you so much, and happy Veterans Day to all of them out there. Again, Mike mentioned in the beginning, go visit our friends at the aid station down in Auburn on High Street. And I'm sure you'll find some good chat there, and some hopefully some beer and some gear that you might need. And also, absolutely, look up Monsters of Massage. I've been going there. I've got a little plantar fasciitis kicking up, and hopefully they'll get it squeezed out for me pretty soon here. But they've been great, and definitely been going there for a couple of years now, and really can't say enough. So thanks all. We have another interview tomorrow night. We're going to be talking to Dan Barger. He recently completed the Western States 200 out and back. Can't wait to hear what that 200-mile experience was like. And so join us again tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, and we'll be here live on Zoom. Thanks again, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.